is he doing here?
He's got the toe of his stick blade. He's going to pin the puck to the ice.
And the Habs are going to go 4-1 on this five-game road trip.
I thought that we had a lot of emotion in the game.
Huge stop on the penalty kill. 5-2 winners over Toronto. What a win tonight in downtown Winnipeg.
The big plays. The big stories. The biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus joins us behind the glass. He's on loan, of course, from Rick Ralph in the TSN 1290 Roundtable, which you can hear Monday through Friday on this fine station. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Coming up on today's program in about 45 minutes' time, the color analyst for the Minnesota Wild, Mike Greenlay, is going to join us. 30 minutes after Mike, at 7:15 p.m. from CBC's Hockey Night in Canada, PJ Stock is going to join us. We're going to start tonight's show, though, with John Tortorella and the New York Rangers. They will be in Winnipeg tomorrow evening to play against the Winnipeg Jets, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. And last night, John Tortorella, in my estimation, pushed his chips into the middle, put his chips all in as it relates to his future coaching of the New York Rangers.
Drew, desperation, obviously, I think, is one word that you may want to use in terms of describing Tortorella last night. You know, you talk about chips in the middle, and you have to wonder if this is the right time. I realize it's a short season, but the Rangers are by no means out of it. And that kind of worries me if I'm a Ranger fan, because I'm wondering why he's pushing the panic button with, you know, still about 20 games to go. 23 games to go. I'm not particularly sure how many New York has.
They played 25, so I think they have 23 games. So I know they have a game in hand on the Winnipeg Jets.
So it's 23 games to go, and you're in a playoff spot right now. Yeah. We all know, as LA indicated last year, you can make a run from any spot, really. Home ice advantage is very, very much overrated at times. So what would lead him, I guess the question rhetorically is what would lead him to have such a reaction? And that gets back to your original point. I mean, does he feel the squeeze? Does he feel some pressure from above? Is that placed upon him by himself, or is that placed upon him by Glenn Sather? That this team has to get it done, especially with the acquisition of Rick Nash.
And Richie, you know, the start that the Rangers have gotten off to is not very good. And you look at what Torts is doing in the media, and as far as I'm concerned, he's just making himself look bad. The Rangers are fighting for their playoff lives, and he is putting everyone around him down. And, yeah, there's pressure on the Rangers to succeed and follow up last year's Eastern Conference Finals appearance, making himself look bad. And, you know, putting down the Buffalo Sabres, putting down, you know, his own team, I'm not sure it's really conducive to turning this abbreviated season around. And, you know, Torts has done this before, but, the act is, it's getting a little old here. And, you know, if he's trying to take pressure off of his team and putting it on himself, or putting the focus on himself and off of his players, it doesn't really matter. I mean, let's start getting some production out of Chris Kreider. Let's start getting some production out of JT Miller, Brian Boyle, a lot of the guys that were doing good last year, and stop putting everyone else down. I mean, you know, that's not really a way to get your team back and ready to go for the playoffs. This isn't a team that's just going to be happy to get back into the playoffs. I mean, the Rangers are a good team, and it seems like he's almost losing focus here and losing his mind a little bit again today in Winnipeg.
Motivation is a key issue in hockey. It may be the most important issue in terms of coaching a squad with the players nowadays. Not that motivation wasn't important long time ago and even in the recent past, but we had Andrew Gross on from the Bergen Record last week.
Right.
And I thought the question or the answer to the question that to me meant the most was, you know, he hasn't really changed his style from last year. The personnel has changed. The team is not as deep. They're more top heavy, but they're also more skilled. And he hasn't amended that style of play in accordance with the talent level that he has. And if that's the case, then maybe instead of going off all the time, he has to look inside and say, hold on a second, what can I do to make this team better? You know, will the screaming help? Well, it doesn't seem to be helping. And then, you know, I mean, as everybody's seen in that 24/7, Bruce Boudreau came in there, and he's done a great job with Anaheim, but he came in there, and he kept yelling and yelling. You could see the players weren't listening anymore. What can you do to make this team better? And I think he keeps going to the well, and I guess you're alluding to at the beginning of the segment, Drew, he may be going to the well one too many times.
Well, I think you'll find out tomorrow. I mean, we were talking about this off-air before the show started, and I said if the Rangers come out tomorrow and they lay an egg and, you know, the Jets beat them, you know, 4-1 or even 3-1 and it's a dominant performance and they show no signs of life, that's a sign to me that the coach has lost the dressing room. And once the coach has lost the dressing room, you can't get it back. It's time to, you know, that coach is a dead man walking, really. And I think you'll see it. And you saw it in the Buffalo game right after when Lindy Ruff got dismissed right after they lost to the Jets. They showed no passion, no effort. Last night, they put out an embarrassing performance, at least in the estimation of their coach. I don't know what the players think about it. But the coach says that we were embarrassing in the lack of passion that we had. And then if they don't respond to that challenge from the coach, that to me tells me they've tuned him out completely and it's time for the coach to go. And a message like Tortorella's. And there's numerous good coaches in the NHL whose message runs thin. Tortorella, Carlisle, Ken Hitchcock. Guys who are really hard on their players and really sort of difficult coaches to be coached by. They all have a very limited shelf life, and Tortorella's might be getting to run thin there in New York.
Boys, for us to sit in the studio here, you know, in Winnipeg, and talk about whether or not Torts has lost the dressing room, it's obviously going to be impossible because we're not in that dressing room, and you'd have to ask the players, and you'd have to ask the coaching staff, and of course, they're going to tell you absolutely not. But the way he's conducting himself after games, pre-games, his level of irritability, it's nothing new with John Tortorella, but the frequency, I mean, and when you consider that the Rangers went out and they acquired Rick Nash. They didn't acquire Rick Nash, just for fun. They acquired Rick Nash to put them over the top, give them that extra scoring punch, and win a Stanley Cup.
Rick Nash hasn't been the problem on the New York Rangers. That's something else that Andrew Gross said on our program last
Saturday.
Especially
as of late. He's been better.
He's been the best player the Rangers have had.
Right, and when you consider that what Richie mentioned, you know, his style of play and how he's adapting to what the Rangers have this year. And again, you know, he's benched guys, Brian Boyle being one of them, and hasn't got the production. And it seems that he has run out of options based on what he does to motivate his players. And, you know, it does wear thin when you keep going to the same tactics of benching guys, putting guys down. And last night was a little bit different because he did it to others. He did it to another team, not only himself.
But I don't care what he said to Buffalo. Yeah, it's a rude thing to do and it's a jerk thing to do. But, I mean, it's not a newsflash at this point in time that the guy's a jerk.
But more, I want to get back to the issue, to me, is a style of play. And you look at the Rangers' output, and they have 64 goals in 25 games. That puts them at second last in the Eastern Conference, ahead of only Ottawa, who's been completely ravaged by injuries.
Yep. Right.
So my question is then,
it's shocking.
Look at the roster, okay? And you're looking at the roster that you're comparing. You're looking at Rick Nash, Brad Richards, Marian Gaborik, Derek Stepan. You're looking at Ryan Callahan. JT Miller's had some has obviously some skill. Chris Kreider's been in the lineup for periods of time this year. Look at the back end. Ryan McDonough, Michael Delzato, Mark Stahl, when healthy. All those guys can move the puck. All those guys have offensive talent, not to mention the goaltender they have, who's arguably the best in the league, and Henrik Lundqvist. But the puck movement. All the players I mention are elite, are very above average or elite skill level or have that potential in them. And if you look at the teams around the Rangers in the standings in terms of goals for Ottawa, New Jersey, who doesn't have as much talent as the Rangers, and is getting going, I think, well, we'll get going, excuse me, Florida, Winnipeg.
So you're saying it's time for him to open it up a little bit, especially knowing that, yes, by opening it up, you might be leaving yourself a little bit more vulnerable on the back end, but you have the best goaltender in the league to bail you out of any sticky situations, or way more than, say, the goaltender in Florida would, or a lot of the mediocre goaltenders in the league.
I think that's exactly right, Drew. I don't see why you don't load up, let it go, and try and score a bit. I mean, this is a think about it in this way. Pittsburgh's obviously a very talented squad, but Pittsburgh has 36 more goals than the Rangers and have played only two more games. 36.
And obviously, I think we would agree that the Pittsburgh skill level offensively is better than that of the Rangers, but it's not 36 goals better.
That's right.
It's, you know, you give any coach in this league the top six forwards that the New York Rangers have, they would tell you, we expect to be top five in goal scoring. Nash, Gaborik, etc. You expect to be top five, Brad Richards. You're probably 100% right. It seems like he's so stubborn and set in his ways that sometimes, like you say, the coach has to adapt to the players he's got. Uh-huh. Well, he continues to try and drive that square peg into the round hole of his defensive system.
And that's why the outburst, to me, don't really make much sense, because he's like yelling at the team and pushing it down their throat that they're not playing up to their capabilities. But to me, he's an impediment to them playing up to their capabilities by the way that he's coaching the squad right now.
And he's got them going better here. They've been playing a little bit better. Not last night, but, you know, they're on a decent run.
That's the point. That's why the rant from last night is so bizarre, is that, you know, they had been playing better. Their numbers aren't terrible. They need a couple minor adjustments, and I think they could be right back up into at least the middle of the pack in the Eastern Conference. But when he goes out on that rant, it makes every other rant he goes on, when he really might need to go on a rant, that much less effective. Sorry for interrupting, Jazzy.
I agree. And, you know, again, looking at what he's saying after games, I don't see how you can possibly spin this in a positive light. I mean, the New York Rangers have started to play better. And if, you know, whether they finish 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 1st, 2nd, they're still going to be competitive in the Stanley Cup race because they have great goaltending, great defense, and a lot of talent on forward. And it's almost like he's acting like, you know, this team is massive underachievers. And, you know, that falls on him. But the way he's going about it in... I mean, I look at it maybe in the media being a little bit different, but he's struggling to get his message across to his players, and I think he projects it after games.
Doesn't necessarily strengthen your relationship either to put the big-time signing of last summer on the second power play unit and kind of demote him, a player obviously he had a relationship with Brad Richards in Tampa Bay. So yeah, you have to wonder if that's... I don't know at all. The relationship must be great. It might be great. I have no clue. And that being said there in Tortorella. Or maybe that's a shot across the bow. I have no clue. That's pure speculation. But just interesting dynamics there for a player they spend so much money on to be logging second power play unit with the likes of Taylor Pyatt is odd to me.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's leave it there. When we come back, we're going to go into Break It Down, and we're going to break down the New York Rangers power play. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. We spent the first segment of the show discussing the New York Rangers and John Tortorella's coaching thereof. Let's talk about them and their power play with Break It Down.
Break It Down.
As I mentioned, Break It Down this Wednesday evening will focus on the New York Rangers power play. Currently, coming into tomorrow night's game at MTS Center, 23rd in the NHL with a success rate of 15.7%. before we get really deep into the sort of the setup of the power play, how bizarre do you guys find it that Brad Richards, their marquee free agent signing from just a couple of years ago, just a prolific offensive force in the NHL, is not on their first power play unit?
It is odd, Drew. I've watched Rangers play a number of times this year. I haven't obviously watched every single game, but it is weird just because if you look at the unit they put out there at number one, and it's a formidable unit, but it's, is there any guy in that group aside from Delzato who's really a puck distributor? And I don't think you can say naturally that they are. And I think that that's the most odd to me. I mean, that's what you're paying Brad Richards for, is you're paying him to, you know, he likes to play the point, Brad Richards. He can play the half boards as well. You're paying him to be the passer. You're paying him to be the setup guy. You're paying him to set the table. And he's playing right now, as of Buffalo last night, with JT Miller, Taylor Pyatt, Anton Strahlman, Matt Gilroy. I mean, there's a huge discrepancy there in the talent level that he'd be playing with if he was on the number one unit. And you have to wonder why.
The first unit of the Rangers has five guys: Rick Nash, Michael Delzato, Marian Gaborik, Derek Stepan, and Ryan Callahan. So four forwards and one D, as we've seen, has become, you know, somewhat common. And as we've done a number of these different break it down segments, we've seen that more than once. You know, the top of the blue line was where Michael Delzato sets up.
Yep.
So, you know, Delzato at the top of the blue line, and then Marian Gaborik is at the weak side top of the blue line.
Yeah, so he'd be on the left side. If you're looking at it from right to left, or if you're looking at it from the red line, looking at the goal, Delzato would be at the top of the blue line, and Gaborik would be to his left.
Okay. On the half boards on his off wing.
So on the right side.
On the right side is Rick Nash.
Yeah.
And then Derek Stepan is in the high slot, which would be sort of between the tops of the circles, give or take.
And between the hash marks or a little higher, yeah.
And then Ryan Callahan is the big bruising force in front of the net, the guy who's, you know, plugs away and gets his, you know, the dirty goals, as they like to say.
There's nobody, you could pull all 30 GMs and they'd all take Ryan Callahan in a second.
And he's leading the Rangers with five goals on the power play.
It's sort of a hybrid 1-3-1. Can you maybe walk through what you mean by that?
Guys, I mean, you look at this unit, and it's not some, you know, because you don't have a Richards or a St. Louis, as you're looking at the 1-3-1, you know, you have Nash. 1-3-1s generally run through the half boards, through the side, so on the right or the left. Gaborik and Nash, not that they can't pass, but they're not natural passers.
Right.
And so the power play doesn't just function through those guys. That's where they're stationed, but there's a lot of movement on this power play. And so if Delzato is at the top of the blue line and he starts moving towards the right side, Gaborik kind of moves with him. And then you get Nash moving, and then you get Stepan moving. And there's so and I think actually it's quite difficult to defend when you have so many players moving in so many different directions. To me, the puck movement on this power play was crisp. I don't think the 23rd overall in the NHL is indicative of, first of all, the talent level, but second of all, the execution. So what a traditional 1-3-1 is, you'll have the ability to pass to a guy in the high slot. You can put the puck on net, or you can look in the weak side. Now, one difference to note is that you have Nash Ezzy on the right side on his off wing, but you have Gaborik on the left side on his strong wing, meaning unless Gaborik is streaking towards the net, that one-time pass across the ice is difficult to execute.
Because it's coming off. It's coming all the way across his body, and then he has to release it, and it's not in generally a good shooting position when he receives the puck.
And so one thing you'll see is if the puck's on the left side, Stepan will move out of the high slot into the corner, the left corner, and curl up, and then everybody will move over, and then Gaborik will move into the high slot. So they're kind of reversing. Do you remember, like, if you played Madden when you were a kid, you press like L1 or L2, and it totally reversed the play on the other side? It's essentially doing that. But instead of the players staying in the same spots, the players are all switching, which is a good method in terms of success, because you're putting players in better positions to succeed.
Let me interrupt you there. You talk about the players switching to be in a better position to succeed. Do you find it odd that they don't station those players in a position to succeed on the get-go, that they sort of have to rely on it as a part of the moving parts of the power play? It doesn't automatically get into that position on the setup?
It happens to be, though, Drew, that their best players, and Ed's going to test this, their best players are all left-handed shooting. Richards, Nash, Gaborik. It's not like St. Louis and Stamkos are lefty and a righty. It's easier to make that work. And Elliot Freeman wrote about that in 30 Thoughts about how Boston basically has a balanced roster of left and right-handed shooting players. So they have to sometimes change it up, and that's what happens is you're switching sides a lot, and it makes it a little bit more difficult to execute, but also difficult to defend at times.
Right, and I think I agree with that, and everybody would agree with that there's a lot of talent, and the power play should be better than it is. And you look at, you know, when you put four forwards on the power play, and you have a lot of shooters out there, and, you know, that's also a problem. And Del Zotto has a good shot. And look at last night in Winnipeg, you know, Byfuglien just shoots it and goes off of Antropov. And it almost seems like you've got too much talent. But, yeah, the Rangers are definitely a team that hasn't been taking advantage of the power play, and you've got guys like Rick Nash with one power play goal, and it's really surprising because he's a guy that's been good on the power play throughout his career. Mm-hmm. And I don't like a guy like Gabrick on the point. I'm not a fan, you know, I'm not a fan of using Jokinen on the point. You know, the power play as it's set up in its, you know, classic way, it's not conducive to having a fast guy who likes to score off of the wing as your point man, as your setup man. And that's why Richards has to be out there on the first power play unit.
And that's a great point, is, you know, especially Gabrick, you mentioned, he kind of scores off the speed, he scores off the wing. But then that's when you get in the problem of the skill. You know, this isn't a fantasy team.
Right.
And so where does Gabrick, and I'm thinking about this right now, based on the system they play, theoretically change the system on the power play, but based on the system they play, where else do you put Gabrick? You put him on the main point, well, we already don't really like him on the point, and Del Zotto's good up there. If you put him in the high slot, well, then what do you do when Nash has the puck, which is a common occurrence, on the right side? Then he's rendered useless in the middle. If you put him in front, well, first of all, Callahan's great in front, but then Gabrick's not tough enough to really stand and get a beating, and he's injury-prone. So the pieces sound great.
Well, what happens if they went for a more of a balance on their two power play lines? I mean, you look at this first power play unit.
Good point.
Tremendously top heavy, great skill all the way through 1 through 5. Then you look at the second power play unit, which we haven't talked about because, well, frankly, it's not much of a second power play unit. Mm-hmm. Matt Gilroy, Anton Strahlman.
It was last night, yeah.
I mean, yeah, last night, Brad Richards, JT Miller, and Piatt.
But looking through, not just last night's game, obviously, when you're analyzing this, I mean, you'll see different players, obviously, McDonough and those players will
sure,
get in there.
People get
but at forward, yeah. It's not much different. I mean, you're seeing Miller's getting some ice time, and Piatt's on it. Been on power play for a little while now.
Well, I mean, in this room, and, you know, you look around the NHL, I'm willing to bet 30 NHL coaches, you say that Taylor Piatt's going to be on your power play unit. Most people will take that and say, okay, we're willing to have to defend against that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you're rendering Brad Richards almost not one on four, yeah, as the case may be, mm-hmm, but you're rendering him relatively insignificant. You can really load up and to stop Brad Richards and say, look, if these other guys beat us, so be it.
You know, guys, we've been breaking down power plays and penalty, mm-hmm, kills for, what, 6 weeks now?
Sure, give or take.
And it's really fascinating how a good 5-on-5 team like the New York Rangers has such a bad power play. Yeah. Or in previous years, the Pittsburgh Penguins, who were Stanley Cup champions just 4 years ago, mm-hmm, had a terrible power play and have finally got it going. And then you look at the Lightning, they're not even in the playoff picture right now, and they've got one of the best power plays in the NHL. And the power play, and I think that's the whole point why we're doing this, the power play and the penalty kill, it really is a unique thing, a unique aspect of hockey that it's kind of, you stop everything and you freeze it into one zone, right?
Well, you have an advantage. You have five guys against
right,
the other team's
right,
four. If generally speaking, if you can't take advantage of those situations, it's hard to believe you're going to be a long-term successful team over the course of a year.
You look at a team like, and I always go back to the Devils. I apologize for people who listen to the show on a regular basis, but the Devils had such successful penalty kill, and they put out John Madden, Jay Pandolfo, Scott Stevens, and Ken Danico. Obviously, they had Brodeur in net. But you look at those four guys, and aside from Stevens, who definitely didn't score a lot of goals later in his career, mm-hmm, but those guys were all just role players. Those weren't the most talented guys. Sure, Madden would, you know, could get 15 goals. He wasn't just a penalty kill guy. But it's because those guys became penalty kill specialists. But on the power play, I mean, you kind of do need specialized roles. Everyone has to have a specialized role because, as Richie's explained very well, it's all about set plays and mm-hmm. where your positions are the strongest. That's why the New York Rangers, you can't just throw out, and that's what I think Richie's trying to say, is you can't just throw out all the talented forwards out there and hope that they're just going to circle around the zone and make a nice little tic-tac-toe play. No, you've got to think about it a little bit more and you know, have a guy with a good shot, some size, a guy that likes to come off the half boards. You have to find the right mix. They haven't found it.
Well, if you make a pie or a cake out of a ton of different types of chocolate, it sounds good on paper, but when you go and taste it, it might not taste that good. Might be too sweet.
I don't know what that means, but I'm hungry.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six.
Six things we learned this week for this Wednesday evening. Ezra Ginsberg, we'll start with you. The Vancouver Canucks, as currently constructed, do not have enough secondary scoring to be a dominant team in the Western Conference anymore.
And even though I learned that this week and was thinking about it this week, that is nothing new. Let me put that out there right off the bat. I'm not the first person to say this. All the Vancouver guys and already know about this. Going into the season, Ryan Kessler was injured, and he was coming back, and we knew that secondary scoring was going to be an issue. And now Ryan Kessler's injured again, and guess what? The Vancouver Canucks aren't scoring enough, and they've gone into a bit of a tailspin here. And what they've done most recently is they've sent Jordan Schrader down to the AHL, and they've called up Andrew Ebbett. All due respect to Andrew Ebbett, that's not going to solve their problems. And if you look at what's happening with the Vancouver Canucks, Mason Raymond stopped scoring, Alexander Burrows has stopped scoring, David Booth is just back from an injury, he's got 2 points in 10 games, no goals, and he was brought in for secondary scoring. And again, just like the New York Rangers guys, the Vancouver Canucks aren't in it just to make the playoffs again. There's a window closing on this team with the Sedins. They're not, in their first year in the NHL. And that has to be addressed immediately because, guess what? Cody Hodgson probably would look pretty good on that second line of the Vancouver Canucks right now, giving them some offense. Right now, you look at the Vancouver Canucks scoring this year, it's Sedin, and then a big drop-off, then everybody else. And nobody's putting the puck in the net. As a guy like Zach Cassian was on the top line, he was scoring early in the season. That's disappeared. So the Vancouver Canucks have to either get something going aside from Andrew Ebbett. I don't think that's going to be the answer. Or they make a trade here because they can't score. They've lost a couple games to Columbus, and that's a huge issue for them right now.
Yeah, they also can't draft, and that's a big organizational issue.
Five.
Richard Pollock, the Flames from Calgary are 28th in the NHL in goals against per game, but that is not a complete indictment of the team's defensive core.
It's not true, because you watch this team play and their offense is terrible, and people sometimes forget that. Oh, they look and they say, oh, the Flames look awful defensively, 28th in the league in goals against. Are they great? No. Do they ever have the puck in the offensive zone for more than 3.5 seconds? Not really. And that's the thing. They don't have possession of the puck. They don't sustain pressure enough on offense to be able to give their defense a breather and allow the defense to, play to their strengths. The defense as a whole is actually not bad. And that top four, Brody, Weidman, Bomeister, Giordano, could all skate, could all move the puck. I actually was quite impressed by them. They're not maybe necessarily one guy who's a complete shutdown defenseman. They can all play. It's the forwards that cannot carry their weight. There's a lack of talent there, clearly. And that's a huge factor in the fact that they're 28th overall in the NHL in goals against.
Four.
Ezra Ginsberg is about to be excommunicated from the New Jersey Devils fan club with this thought, but the New Jersey Devils need to acquire a number one goaltender with NHL experience.
Tonight, the New Jersey Devils are hosting the Philadelphia Flyers. It's starting right now. And
game's available on TSN, too.
Absolutely. And Johan Hedberg is going to make his 10th consecutive start. This season, Johan Hedberg is 4-7-2. with a 2.79 GAA and an 879 save percentage. That's just not good enough, and I've watched the Devils more than any other team aside from the Jets this year, and he's let in weak goals, and he hasn't looked good. And I know he was, you know, a good goalie for the Manitoba Moose, and he was good for the Devils last year, but he's not getting it done. The status of Martin Brodeur is by no means known right now. He's suffering from a back injury. And next year, he said he'll be back, but he's got max maybe 2 years left. Mm-hmm. And the Devils need to address that situation now, or it's going to cost them possibly a playoff spot, whether it's Jonathan Bernier, whether it's another goaltender. They were talking about that on TSN last night. They've got to address that now. If they don't address that now, they've got to address it in the offseason, and I think that might be too late.
Three.
Richard Pollock, looking closely at the defenses across the Western Conference, no team jumps out to you as being able to handle the LA Kings forward size-wise in a seven-game series.
It's trouble for the Western Conference, Drew. They take the puck down the cycle, and they don't give it up. And they're big, and they're deep, and they come in waves. And, you know, there are some players who can do that. You know, Seabrook and Chalmerson and things like that in Chicago. But 1-6, I'm not so sure they can't. You know, Oduya has trouble against the boards. Keith is a great defenseman, not the biggest guy in the world, though. You know, you look at St. Louis. Well, I mean, guys like Redden and guys like Russell, well, they can't handle them. You know, Minnesota's young on the back end and not necessarily deep. A guy like Tom Gilbert isn't that strong on the boards. There's a lot of teams that are, Vancouver, not bad in terms of defensively, but obviously offensively, as he touched on that just a few minutes ago. So when I look overall at the Western Conference, if one of those teams, you know, they say the road goes through the champion, I really believe that to be the case this year. And I think if a team like Chicago or a team like St. Louis, I think the playoffs or the other teams that we've discussed or other teams that we haven't discussed, they have to add a little bit of size on the back end if they want to be able to go through the champs.
Two.
Ezra Ginsberg, if you have hate in your heart, let it out. And right now you hate the shootout more than ever.
It's funny how, you know, this putting the puck on the toe of your stick, and, you know, I'm talking about the Caspers, Dogovins shootout move. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And this is my opinion, and I know that there are people listening and people on Twitter that disagree with me big time and think it's entertaining. To me, hockey is about winning, and it's about competing. Yes, it's entertainment, but this isn't your opportunity to entertain. Entertain somebody in a skills competition. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous that he tried that. And don't tell me that it would have been, it was okay because he almost scored. It's absolutely ridiculous to do that nonsense. If it's such a great move, why don't people use it all the time? Don't give me that it's an interesting move. I'm all for entertainment, okay? I'll watch WWE Monday Night Raw every week. But
then he actually acts out the matches he sees, which is a little bit odd.
I used to do that when I was a kid.
When you're the Ottawa Senators.
Yeah, when you were a kid.
You're in the thick of the playoff race. Do a traditional move.
I like the move, actually.
I don't think. It doesn't bother me. The whole thing is.
What did I say at the beginning? A lot of people are
right.
Going to disagree.
The whole thing is. And I mean, we won't spend more than 2 minutes talking about it.
I hate the shootout.
Yeah, I hate the shootout also. Yeah. But the whole thing is contrived and ridiculous, so why not make the attempt contrived and ridiculous?
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, I've been an advocate. You go four on four for 10 minutes, or after you go 4-on-4 for five, go 3-on-3 for five.
I like that too, but I did like Glenn Healy's suggestion. I'm not sure if it was his own or he mentioned it on the Hot Stove last week about switching ends, because it'll be a longer change. If there's a longer change in 4-on-4, they're probably more apt to allow more goals to teams.
Let's go back to the days of tie games.
And I'm in favor of the switching sides. Why not? You don't lose anything.
Two.
Richard Pollock, Dale Tallon didn't let last season's mirage skew his long-term vision for the Panthers, and his decision not to make any hasty moves will benefit the team long-term.
Hold on. Remus.
Yeah, that was one, Remus.
That was one.
Yeah. You managed not to be able to count down from 6-1 properly.
You pressed 2 twice.
Honestly, you know what? I have the pleasure. I'm often in the car around lunchtime,
sure.
Driving around, running
sure.
some errands. When he's on with Rick, clean as a whistle.
Yeah.
No errors, nothing.
He brings his A game.
He's been sitting here trying to get the channels properly on the television.
You keep
here.
Changing the game I'm watching.
You guys asked me to put the games on, so I put...
You had the games on. Why did you need to change them?
Because I want to watch the games, too.
You pressed 2 twice.
Look, you try to change one TV, it changes all of them.
Don't blame the television. Look, blame the guy pressing the buttons.
Drew, you didn't put the order in the show plan. That's what I'm blaming.
Oh.
I look at the show plan.
It's in the show plan.
And it says, oh, Richard will put him in later. I want an updated show plan.
Okay. Guys, give Reem a bit of a break. He's a little sleep deprived.
Richie, finish it off with Dale Talon.
Remus, I emailed that to you, by the way. Dale Talon, you know, I like, back to that point, Dale Talon shown great patience in Chicago. And I think that's coming to the forefront here in Florida. You know, they had a little bit of a surprise year last year, the Panthers, but he didn't try and mortgage the farm to try and make another surprise this year. He understands, you know, a guy like Huberdeau and another top pick, and obviously the bunch of other young talent they have there, that's gonna grow, and that's exactly what happened in Chicago. And Dale Talon, able to do it quietly, nobody's really paying attention. They'll get another high pick this year, and they're going to be in darn good shape, luckily for the Jets, out of their division in about 2 to 3 years.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. When we come back, the color analyst for the Minnesota Wild, Mike Greenlay, is going to join us. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Michael Remus is behind the board looking a little bit confused. Should we bring in Mike Greenlay? How about we just do that? We'll bring in Mike Greenlay. He's the Minnesota Wild color analyst, and he's going to join us now on NHL Midweek. Mike, good evening. How are you?
How about yourself?
We're doing well. Thank you very much. Mike, you got to start with what happened last night between the Ducks and the Minnesota Wild. Your thoughts on Corey Perry's hit on Jeff Zucker?
Well, you know what? Obviously, it was a late hit. You know, I guess one side of me said that, you know, Jason Zucker was kind of looking back up the boards towards where his pass was because, you know, and I didn't ask him this, but I'm sure that what he was trying to figure out was whether the puck stayed in the zone, because if it does, then he, you know, drives to the net. If he doesn't, then he obviously has to, you know, button hook and get back and back check. Mm-hmm. But, you know, by the time he was turning his head back towards the center of the ice area, Corey Perry was finishing his hit, and it was late and it was high, and you know, and he took the brunt of it up high. So you know, I mean, you got four games for it. You know, I guess, you know, people can talk about it either way. You know, he deserves this, he deserves that, but bottom line is you got four games. And, you know, hopefully Zucker doesn't, you know, have any residual effects. He kind of skated a little bit today after everyone else had skated. So, you know, with head issues, if there are any, they usually show up a little bit later than immediately after. So we'll see how he does down the stretch here. But you know what? It was a late hit. And I think a lot of guys, even Corey Perry said, you know, I'd committed to the hit, and I stepped, and he even said he tried to pull back a bit. But bottom line is, even if it had been a late hit, the problem is that it was a high hit. And I know Zucker's not a big guy, but you have to know who you're hitting, I guess. And if you're hitting a smaller guy, then maybe you have to, I don't know, bend your knees a little more. I'm not sure.
Mike, you know, based in obviously Winnipeg, somehow we're in the Eastern Conference this year, and we haven't really had a chance to see the Wild, although next year they'll be in the Jets division. Last season we did get to see Minnesota, and they played a pretty tight, you know, defensive game. Has Mike Gill changed his style at all to you know, maybe better suit the infusion of offensive talent that was acquired or called up or developed over the past couple of years or during the offseason?
You know what? They're still playing tight defensively, and that's, you know, that's what they want to do. I think they, you know, I think the Wild are in the sixth or seventh range in a lot of the defensive categories, which is what they want to be. I mean, they want to win games, but you know, this is not a you know, as soon as you tell somebody that you're concentrating on being tight defensively and managing managing your end of the ice, they immediately think that you're, you know, Jacques Lemaire system again. But it's, you know, it can't be anything, you know, there can't be any more different than that, just in the fact that this team is trying to score goals. They strive to score goals. It's just that sometimes you don't score as many goals as you want to, and sometimes you have to win the 2-1, 3-2 game. No, this is not an offensive juggernaut, but The Wild still are trying to find a way to score goals. I mean, they have rookies on their first two lines, and they have a rookie on their top defensive pair. And even though they're very talented young kids, they are still young kids, and they and so this is still a lineup that wants to win games by scoring goals. But when the goals aren't going in, you got to win the games another way, and that's where they kind of would like to rely on a solid defensive effort in their own end to help move the puck out of the zone.
Mike, Mikko Koivu and Zach Parise have played a lot on the first line this year. You know, Parise's a pretty unique player with what he offers in speed and other attributes. How do you think that they've meshed together as line mates on that first line?
You know, I think they've done pretty well. They're both very aggressive, forechecking, aggressive skating guys. I don't know if you would call either one of them pure goal scorers. I mean, you know, you look at some, there's some guys in the league where, basically that's the puck gets on their stick and there's a very good chance to score. A guy like Koivu doesn't shoot the puck a ton. He sets the table a lot. When he does score, it's usually an aggressive move. Zach Parise, his is about quality and quantity and effort. And then this guy never stops moving his feet, never stops skating. So he's an effort goal scorer, if you want to call it that. He's gonna score on you because he's gonna get, he's gonna get eight shots in a game. He's gonna score on you because he's gonna outwork you to get the puck. That's the kind of scorer that Parise is. And so these two guys have meshed pretty well together, and I don't think they could have Charlie Coyle, who's playing on that top line now as a 21-year-old. I don't think he could have two better mentors right there, because the style and the effort that those guys put into every game, the intensity and the compete level that both of those guys bring every night. I mean, if there's not a better example, then I would challenge people to tell me a better one, because they certainly, have that effort every night.
You're listening to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. We're joined by Mike Greenlay. He's the color analyst for the Minnesota Wild. Mike, much was expected this season from Mikael Granlund, the Wild player. He was just sent down to the minors earlier this week. What has held him back thus far in the NHL?
You know what? It's about managing your game a little bit, and what I mean by that is he's not an overly big player, and when you're 175 pound guy, I mean you have to learn how to have better body position. You're not going to have the free flowing style of the European game. There's defensive nuances that need to be learned. You have to learn how to leverage your body along the wall in order to win pucks, in order to separate opposition from the pucks. There's so many nuances to the NHL game, and then you, on top of all of that, you add the speed of the game, which he certainly is. He's not foreign to the speed of the game, but you have to do all of the things that I just said. You have to do them at a higher rate of speed, and so it's certainly not a failure that he came up here and moved around through the lineup and didn't maybe get the consistency in games that he wanted and the consistency in scoring that everyone expected. I mean, that the National Hockey League separates a lot of people. Some guys come up and they fit the game well. Some guys come up and need to go back and work on a few things and then come back up and see how they fare in that way. So, it's not a failure for a guy that age and that skill set to go back to Houston, work on parts of his game, the North American style hockey, and then come back up and see what he can do then. He certainly still has a very bright light with his organization, and we'll see how he fares. This is part of the development process. This is not, people always want to put a grade on everything, but for a guy like that, I mean, the fact that he stepped right up there into the National Hockey League immediately and he's learned now some of the things he has to go back and work on. And so I think in the long run, it'll be better for him.
You know, Mike, you talk about Granlund. Obviously, he's had some initial struggles, and he's still young. But one player that's really impressed and been Jonas Brodin on the back end. I mean, Ryan Suter obviously gets the attention and well deserved. But Jonas Brodin is second on the team in defensive ice time. How impressive has he been to you thus far?
You know what? This is an anomaly, really. I mean, 19-year-old guy that has the poise that he does. We all still shake our head. You know, we should check his birth certificate. He plays like a 25-year-old. I mean, he has a lot of poise with the puck. He makes smart decisions. He doesn't panic with the puck. And you see a lot of young guys, they get the puck on their stick, and all of a sudden there's pressure, and they make a quick snap decision, and a lot of times it could be wrong. He, on the other hand, will buy a little more time, make another move, use his body, whatever he has to do. But he'll make a very smart decision with the puck, and you don't typically see that kind of decision making in a young player like that. So yeah, I mean, I think the Wild knew that he'd have an opportunity to step into the lineup. I don't think anyone really knew that he would step up in the lineup and be a top two D man, which he certainly is. And there's no question that this guy is going to be here for a long time, and it's pretty nice to see that at 19, because you know that you can count on a guy like that to be in your lineup for years to come. So it's been fun to watch him, because he, there are elements of his game that they definitely want to see more of. I mean, obviously he's playing with Suter, and Suter, you know, is the kind of guy who is a zone exit defenseman, whether it's a carrying it or with a pass. You still want to see some more offensive element to Brodin's game, but my goodness, the fact that he is so solid with the puck in his own end and his body position, stick position, everything he does, his decision making, it's pretty impressive. I mean, we can all think back to what we were doing at 19, and it wasn't that.
You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and we're joined by Mike Greenlay, the color analyst for the Minnesota Wild.
We don't want to know what Ezzy was doing at 19.
Mike. Yeah. Richie set me up nicely here. I wanted to talk about the penalty kill. The Wild's penalty kill has been really good this year. I believe they're still top five. What's been the key to the success on the penalty kill, if it's just the system that they're employing, or if it's specific players that Mike Yao is putting out there?
Well, I think one of the things is the fact that they have a lot of guys that can kill penalties. That's just one thing. I mean, you don't have to pigeonhole two guys in there and then hope for the rest. I mean, they have a good six players or more that you could trust as forwards on the penalty kill, and you all obviously have a couple sets of D that you can trust as well. That's actually a big key, just because of a fatigue factor. I mean, if you get yourself into, one thing is discipline, obviously, because the Wild don't find themselves heavily into penalty trouble very often, but if they do get into it, then they have a lot of guys they can call on. The other thing is that they are patient, but then also aggressive. And what I mean by that is, when the other team is really controlling the puck, they have some patience. They're not jumping and putting themselves out of position. But the minute you see a little bobble of the puck, or a little errant pass, or a battle situation where they may have a chance to jump on the puck, that is immediately when they jump on it, and the aggressive nature that they show, the patience that they show up to that point, it really makes a huge difference. So it's been an interesting thing to watch, because the Wild, as I mentioned, don't really need the penalty kill that much every night. But when they do, they do a very good job at it. Good positioning, and it's fun to watch them really not allow teams to really set up that well either. So it's been a feather in their cap, and it's part of their defensive game. And you know, it's something that has helped them win games.
Final question here, Mike. We'll put you a little bit on the spot. The Wild right now are tied for, sitting in eighth spot right now in the Western Conference. If you're a fan of Minnesota, is there maybe one thing that would give you confidence that the team will make the playoffs? Maybe one issue that concerns you for why they won't make the playoffs?
Well, honestly, the reason why I think they could make the playoffs is just it might be the same reason for both, and that is the fact that it's so close. Mm-hmm. You know, if you find yourself in a situation where I think they have definitely have the coaching and the system and the type of players that you need that you could make the playoffs. That they have the type of makeup, and they've been fairly healthy this year. So that's one thing I look at as the reason why they could make the playoffs. You know, if you want to look at a reason why they won't make the playoffs, they have youth. And so, you know, they just signed Brett Clark on defense. So obviously they're adding some more veterans back there in that regard. Maybe they add another guy up front down the road. I'm not sure. But, you know, they are young. That's one thing that, you know, can be a bit of, you know, an Achilles heel for a team trying to make the postseason. And health, and right now health has been good. But if they get into any kind of injury situation like they did last year, that could hurt them as well. So, hey, you know what? And I think what I just said probably is fairly consistent with most teams in terms of, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room here for a lot of teams. And you guys see the standings as well as we all do. And, you know, there's not a lot of give or take. You know, you win a few games, you're solid. You lose a few games, and you're panicking. So it's going to be interesting to see down the stretch, for sure.
Mike Greenlee is the color analyst for the Minnesota Wild. We won't see him this year, but starting next year, we're going to see a lot of you, Mike. Looking forward to it. Thanks very much for joining us.
I do too, guys. Take care.
Take care, Mike. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. Richard's applauding, giving Remus a bit of the Bronx cheer, as it was, for successfully playing music coming out of the break. Is that what that was about, Richard?
Are mics on, Remus?
You guys got to lay off. That was a computer.
Oh, it's always the computer's fault, isn't it? Anyways, welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Big thank you to Mike Greenlee for having just joined us.
You know, Drew's away next week, Remus. I'm going to need you to step up because when I'm hosting, I mean, there's a lot of pressure.
It's true.
I can handle it.
Okay, good. I'm away. Four shows I'm missing. You guys. The question I have is when I come back, will we still have two shows on air here on TSN 1290?
Maybe we'll have three shows.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have four shows. But you never know. When you're gone for 2 weeks, Drew, a lot can happen. If you want to make those, if you want to change that trip now, you better do it because I don't know. The three of us, we might set the station on fire.
Literally. Welcome back. Quick update from around the NHL. It's a Wednesday night, so it's typically a quiet night at the end of one period in Montreal. A game that you can see on TSN. It is 1-1 between the Habs and the Senators. 9 minutes to go in the first period. 8 minutes to go, rather, in the first period in New Jersey, where the Jets were earlier this week. The New Jersey Devils are up 2-1 on the Philadelphia Flyers. That game is available to you on TSN2. So pretty much what I'm saying, between TSN 1290, TSN, and TSN2, we got you covered for your hockey fix today.
Doubleheader tonight, too.
That's right. And still to come, Detroit at Calgary. That's the doubleheader game. That'll be on TSN after the Ottawa-Montreal game. Guys, some odds and ends from around the NHL. Start with the Corey Perry hit. You know, we just asked Mike Greenlee about it on Jason Zucker. Corey Perry gets suspended for 4 games for the hit. To me, it's about right. You know, I know that Zucker watched his pass and everything, but there's just no reason for. I mean, Perry left his feet. It was a blow to the head. It was blindside. It really just, it was a textbook thing that the NHL is trying to get out of the game. 4 games to me seems pretty legit here.
Corey Perry is a guy who plays on the edge. I love Corey Perry. On Saturday's show, we talked about the Ryan Getzlaff contract that he signed last week and what that means for Corey Perry going forward.
Mm-hmm.
He's a talented guy, and he's only 2 years removed from a Hart Trophy win. But he can be dirty. He's been suspended before. And Corey Perry has a bit of a temper. And we were at the game last night, obviously, at the MTS Center between the Jets and Leafs. So I don't know what happened leading up to that. Maybe there was nothing leading up to that. But Corey Perry clearly gets the elbow up, targets the head against Jason Zucker, who doesn't have the puck, and he's looking the other way.
What about Jeff Zucker?
That's what I called him. You know who Jeff Zucker is.
Is he the NBC producer?
He's the head of, I think, NBC Entertainment. I got the two Zuckers confused, but thank you for... Yeah. And, of course, there's also Ezra Zuckerberg next to me here. That's his Facebook name if you want to find Ezzy on Facebook.
Thankfully, this isn't the Entertainment Weekly radio show, so we're going to stick to Jason Zucker. But that was a dirty hit. It was a dirty hit, and he was suspended 4 games. You could argue that, he could have got more. But 4 games is a lot. He doesn't get paid during that four games. And for Corey Perry, that's a lot more than my salary, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And or lack thereof, as far as this show goes. But I agree with it. And and you know, they're doing a good job. They're being consistent. And it's a scary hit. And again, you know, you got to take this out of the game. And thankfully, it looks like Jason Zucker doesn't have, he might have missed some time here, but it looks like it's not serious. He didn't have to be hospitalized, I don't think. But, you know, it's a dirty play. You got to get that out of here, and you got to penalize the guy when he does it.
You got to wonder, you know, when there's a hit like this, because Corey Perry's a repeat offender, but if Corey Perry is a grinder and he scores 13 goals a year,
might get 10.
That's the question I always ask. You know, what would he have got if he wasn't Corey Perry?
So you're saying it might have been four, might be safe. You're not going to give him two, but four is kind of safe.
I think his status as an elite player in the league affords him a lesser suspension. That's my opinion. The play I thought was dirty. Corey Perry, as he mentioned, plays on the edge.
Yeah.
You can't have that play, though. I mean, it's not necessary. I understand finishing your checks and all that stuff, but it's not finishing your checks.
The puck was nowhere near Zucker.
The whole finishing your checks has been completely, I mean, it's the same. It's the same term people use, but it has a different meaning than it did 15 to 20 years ago, and a totally different meaning. And you're trying to push the guy, you're trying to kill the guy as opposed to, you know, just hit him, make sure, you know, hit him and make sure you let him know that you're there. It's not like that anymore. I mean, Jeffrey on, I'm assuming we're going to talk about, same idea. I mean, sure, the hit can be considered clean, dirty, whatever you want, but the purpose of a hit is to separate the guy from the puck. Isn't that the goal?
Yeah.
You know, to get the puck back, and now that people just run around. Like, if you watch last night's game, I believe it was Colton Orr on Evander Kane late in the game, when he just tried to literally just impale him. And what was the point of it? It's not the game. He had no intention whatsoever of touching the puck. None. If he would have hit Kane, he wouldn't have taken the puck. He just would have been happy that he hit him at the end of the game. The point is to play the game. And if you need to hit somebody to take the puck away, fine. You know, or you don't want him to come up the middle, I understand. But a hit in the corner like that, I just don't see a need for it. And four games minimum to me, I thought it probably should have been five or six. And if he wasn't Corey Perry, might have been with a history, which Perry has, but his name wasn't Corey Perry, probably would have been six or seven.
Quickly, because we're right up against the break, Jake Gardner's agent, Ben Hankinson, tweeted last night after the Jets-Leafs game, hashtag free Jake Gardner. Jake Gardner has been stuck in the Toronto Marlies playing in the AHL all year long. You know, your thoughts on the agent choosing to do that, and do you see Jake Gardner long for the Toronto Maple Leafs organization so long as Randy Carlyle is the head coach?
Well, first of all, if you want to, you know, get in the good graces of an organization, you won't have you or your agent won't be saying things like that, regardless of whether or not he gave his agent the approval to do that. I think it's classless. I don't like it.
I agree.
In terms of whether he will fit, you know, if you look at the Leafs' left side, you've got Phaneuf, you've got Gunnarsson, Mark Fraser's solidifying it, the 5-6, different player, obviously, than Lyles, or then Gardner. Gardner is a good player, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot of the same player there. So he's getting pushed down a little bit, and he's got options, right? He can still play in the AHL. That's part of the deal. So you know what? Deal with it.
He's playing in the AHL right now with the Marlies, Richie, as you mentioned, and he's playing well, and he's young, but they like what guys like Koska and Holzer, and even though they didn't have a very good game at all yesterday,
they didn't, but
he, like you said, he's buried, and you
different
know,
types
I think
of guys, though, is he? Different types of guys.
Different types of guys, you're right. And, you know, again, people are, you know, on Twitter and everything think this stuff is entertaining, but you're dealing with a guy's career. And, you know, when you think when Carlyle and Nonis look at this, they think this is funny?
Well, but
I don't think so.
But it was done by his own agent, so he's got no one to blame but himself. The case
that's what I'm saying. The agent, I don't know what his, you know, stirring up public opinion.
It's worth mentioning, of course, that Jake Gardner was drafted by Anaheim when Randy Carlyle was there and traded under the auspices of Randy Carlyle.
Yep. Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there is history between the two players.
But it's the same idea. You look at it from both sides. Loophole was in Anaheim with Carlyle. Then Loophole comes to Toronto, and then Carlyle comes to Toronto. And then they give Loophole an extension.
while Carlisle is there.
Yep.
So I'm not sure. The point needs to be mentioned, Drew. I agree. Yep. But I don't know if we should read into it or not.
He's got 30 points in 40 AHL games. For a defenseman, that's not bad.
But if I recall correctly, he's on an entry-level deal, so he can go to the minors without clearing waivers.
Oh, yes.
They have a depth of defenseman. Deal with it.
That's right. I mean, there's no dispute
about it. Stop whining. For God's sake.
Let's go to break. When we come back, PJ Stock from Hockey Night in Canada is going to join us. You're listening to TSN 1290. On TSN 1290, you can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. This segment is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, conveniently located at 1700 Cordon Avenue in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli that has been serving traditional deli food for nearly 30 years. Take it home or eat it there. Bernstein's Deli is your deli destination in South Winnipeg. Check out their website at www.bernsteinsdeli.com. Open on Sundays, starting this coming Sunday,
yes.
9 a.m. this coming Sunday. I know Ezzy's going to be in line.
I'll be in line St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, you'll be wearing green.
Perfect opportunity to stuff your face with borscht and deli meat.
That's all I'm ever looking forward to.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
Let's welcome to TSN 1290 from Hockey Night in Canada, PJ Stock. PJ, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on. Very much appreciate it.
PJ, you got to start with the new Hockey Night in Canada format of sort of the one main studio group throughout the entire broadcast. How are you enjoying that the new setup?
It's great. You know, with Hockey Night in Canada, it's just a great group. I love all the guys. It's a fun group to be with weekly, every Saturday, I guess you can say that. But still, you know, Ron McLean, Don's there. It's a lot of the guys that just the Hockey Night in Canada crew, the onset guys, we get along, and I love the format. But it's the best guys in the business behind the cameras as well. They do such a great job, and as much as we kind of goof around and might not get it right on air, they always get it right behind the air. So just a fun group.
PJ, you're based in Montreal, of course, and the Canadians are off to an unbelievable start at the midway point of the season now. What has surprised you the most about the way the Montreal Canadiens have played this year?
Well, I never really saw this coming. I think it's just their depth. Their depth is probably the most surprising thing. You look at last year, and they couldn't really score. They had problems defending. They were small. And they went in this year, and they have a couple of young guys come in, and they haven't really changed much of their top lines. But they've changed their third and fourth line, and they've added a new logo to their dressing room, I guess. It's no excuses. So all those small guys before that, you know, you'd think of, well, they can't play that physical game or whatever. I mean, we can't score because we're like this. They have a big sign that says no more excuses, and they've taken that approach. And before, they used to have them, well, we're small, that we can't play this way against Boston, we can't play this way against Philly. But they've thrown all that out the door with the model, with those smaller players now playing bigger, and with those fourth-line guys, Brandon Prust. You know, Kobe Armstrong hasn't been the most physical guy, but he's added that dimension of just being a veteran on that fourth line. Ryan White's there. A little Bouillon's been added to the lineup as well. They just added this grit and this more so this mental change that's been probably the most impressive thing. And, man, they're off to a great start, another one tonight.
PJ, the Rangers are in town in Winnipeg to play the Jets tomorrow night, and obviously they're not going to be having Mark Stahl on the back end with an eye injury. Now, as a former player, you know, who didn't wear a visor, can you talk about like how often in a locker room throughout the year that players will chit-chat about wearing visors and kind of engage in that conversation?
It's not really a conversation that the players have with each other. It's not. My career ended by a stick in the eye. So I'm a little stuck on this one. I don't know why everyone's not wearing visors. I just don't get it. When I was playing, it was a little bit different. There weren't as many in the league. There was a lot more fighting back then. Today there isn't. There's no need for, and like a guy like Mark Stahl, with the speed of the game, the speed of the pucks, how light the equipment is, how light the sticks are, how big everyone is, for guys not to be wearing visors. Mark Stahl has been in how many fights in his career? Mm-hmm. So the old taboo about wearing it or not wearing it because you're going to get into a fight or not going to get into a fight, it's useless now. Guys that wear them still get into fights. And you can take it off if that's the case. But there's so much more to life than the game of hockey. And your career might be 4 years, 7 years, 10 years, hopefully. But there's still life after. Living that life with one eye is not the way to go. And I don't know how you can be that much of a better hockey player without a visor. You feel better, because I've known I had to wear the visor and I played without one. You feel better. You feel more free. But how much better are you? And it's, I hopefully think the league is really going to recognize this and sooner or later make it mandatory for everybody.
You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and we're joined by Hockey Night in Canada's PJ Stock. PJ, you know, sticking on the topic or some the insight that you have as being a former player, you know, realignment has been a hot topic throughout the course of this season. Now that it's finally, so it seems as though it's come to a resolution. You know, as a free agent, when you were a free agent, if all money was equal, the different offers you'd have available to you, how much was the travel from one team to another really a consideration for a free agent?
You know, there's a couple ways, and this, you're not going to want to hear this, but you don't really think of it that way all that much, because the teams that are traveling, besides Winnipeg in the situation this year, I mean, you're traveling in Florida, in, you know, Tampa, Anaheim, San Jose, those teams are, but they're the areas they're living in. I mean, that, you don't really think of the travel. Detroit's one situation, but they're every year they're in the mix of being successful. So you want to go to a good team? Mm-hmm. Let me rephrase that. Let me say, if you're not going to go to a good team, if you've got a good team offering you a contract, whether it's Detroit or the Rangers or Vancouver, you look at it that way. But if the teams that are offering you contracts are going to be, hypothetically, Tampa, Florida, Columbus, Minnesota, teams that are finishing always in the bottom tier, I don't think you look at the travel. I think you look at the lifestyle. Travel really doesn't come into consideration. The lifestyle does. And that's why you see, you know, players signing in Dallas. You hear Jagr at the end of his career signing in Dallas. You know, guys signing in Tampa, signing in Florida. You know, if you're going to be on a bad team, well, at least I'll be on a bad team and be in the sun. It's a thing you don't want to hear me say. Well, it never happened to me. But I know that's a thought process of some players.
PJ, we wanted to talk to you about team focus and specifically the New York Rangers. You used to play for the New York Rangers, and as you know, John Tortorella is in town right now, and he's been the center of attention as of late. How much pressure is on the Rangers, and do you think Tortorella is handling that appropriately?
We all love John Tortorella. We all love John Tortorella, but he kind of caught himself in a little bit of a jam here. He goes out and tells, you know, Joe Thornton talks about his team, about how they're not a tough team to play, and then he goes back and snaps on Joe Thornton. And then he does the exact same thing to the Buffalo Sabres last night's performance. And, you know, pretty much says, you know, I'm not coming. It kind of takes a little bit of shot at their team. So John has it his way, and he wants it his way. Unfortunately, in the media, it can't always be John's way. I love a couple years ago, last year in the playoffs, he tried to take his attention away from his team at times. At least we thought that's what he was doing. But you see him do it so often that I think it's no longer John taking attention from his team, taken away from his team. It's just John. And you love him or you hate him for it. At the end of the day, I just think it's really entertaining. And luckily, I'm not one of the guys in those scrums having asking those questions.
like one of us will be. We'll have to be tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, listen. After last night's game, he takes shots at you know, he's blaming his team, and he's not complimenting the other team. They're not playing well. Why aren't they playing well? You know what? Is the reason behind the bench? Did you not motivate him? Did you not fix things? Are they not, you know, I can make up a whole bunch of, you know, maybes and whys, but at the end of the game, he talks about, you know, it's part of the game. You have to be interviewed. You're in New York. You got to talk about why things went well, things didn't go well. And he's telling the reporters, why are you always asking me these questions? Why, did you ask the other team these questions? Of course they did.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's just, it's just nonstop. And it's good. Sometimes it's bad. And when the team's struggling and you're the coach and you're taking shots at the reporters and the other team, sooner or later it's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
PJ, final question is, Sidney Crosby's obviously been incredible this year, and you spend time in New York, and during your time in New York, you got to play with number 99, Wayne Gretzky. Do you see any similarities? I know people always like to look at the similarities between great players, but it's also interesting. Do you see any similarities between Sidney Crosby, maybe his demeanor on the ice and his leadership ability or even his skill level, and Wayne Gretzky?
Things were completely different back then versus today. I mean, Wayne was on top of the world, and Sidney is on top of the world. Wayne couldn't have been taken down back then like a player today can. I think that's a big difference with Twitter and these. I mean, Patrick Kane in a limo doesn't pay a cab driver. I mean, he's unbelievable. The team's fantastic. He has one or two things that he doesn't do. It's everywhere. It's going to follow him the rest of his career. Sidney Crosby, you know, we have some people in the media calling him out. It's just, there's so many more voices today and media outlets that it's tougher for that person to be that person. So what I'm trying to get at is, like, it's hard to play your game at a certain level and live your life that way, to help your game play at that level. I think Sidney's life today is harder than Wayne's was. I don't know if that's... Yeah. I wasn't around Wayne at the beginning of it.
Right.
But on the ice, Gretz is the best player ever to play the game, in my opinion.
I agree.
And he'll always be the best player ever to play the game. Sidney Crosby is amazing, but there's no other Wayne Gretzky.
PJ Stock, you know him from Hockey Night in Canada. Thank you very much for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care, PJ. Thanks very much. You're listening to TSN 1290. Let's go to break. Shortly past 7:30 in the evening, welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Prospect Pulse.
Prospect Pulse for this Wednesday evening. It is our weekly segment where we examine each of the teams in the NHL and their prospects. We've been starting at number 30, and today we are up to number 26, if I'm not mistaken, and that is the Vancouver Canucks. We're joined on the line by the Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey, Kyle Kozier. Kyle, today's topic is the Vancouver Canucks. And probably fans in Winnipeg are more familiar with the prospects on this team than they are almost any other team aside from the Winnipeg Jets themselves.
Yeah, definitely. It's, you know, sort of had the benefit there of seeing quite a few of these guys come through with the Moose. And so it kind of gives, you know, I'd say your listeners have a pretty good level of familiarity with some of the guys we're going to talk about.
I want to start with Eddie Lack. He's obviously injured. I believe he had hip surgery this year, so he's been out of the lineup for the AHL Chicago Wolves. But there's been so much talk surrounding a Roberto Luongo trade that prior to the injury, you know, the thought was, is Eddie Lack ready to take that next step and become, say, a backup goaltender behind Corey Schneider? You know, how has Eddie Lack developed as a goaltender so far, you know, throughout his career in the AHL, and is he ready to make that next step?
Well, I really think he is, and you know, everything you hear about and read about this year suggests that they're really kind of taking it slow with him. You know, they've got two good goalies at the NHL level right now, trying to get Lack ready for training camp next year, which would suggest that, you know, a move will be made, you know, at the trade deadline or perhaps over the summer here. But you know, all indications are, especially from his time in Sweden and again with the Moose in the America League and now Chicago, that he's got certainly has the skills. You know, his numbers last year weren't good, but again, he was slowed by that hip injury. But again, he's really a competitive guy. He's posted really pretty good numbers everywhere he's been, and I really just think that competitive drive is certainly enough to propel him into the NHL level. Certainly as a backup, and maybe down the road as a starter. Of course, with the couple guys in front of him, he might be hard pressed to get in a lot of games, but it certainly helped the Canucks in that backup role.
KK, the next guy on our list is still a prospect, even though he's played 22 games with the Canucks this year. Another guy that played a couple of years with the Manitoba Moose, also played, as you know, University of Minnesota, Jordan Schrader. They've now sent him down back to the AHL, recalled Andrew Ebbett. I like Jordan Schrader. He kind of reminds me a little bit of Mike Comrie. I want to first off know if you agree with that. I know Richie isn't as high on Schrader as I am, but what do you think of his game, and do you think he needs a couple years in the AHL, and maybe what's his ceiling?
Well, the ceiling, I think, is really the big issue there. As with a lot of the Canucks prospects, he's one of those guys that you either kind of like him or you don't, and he could really develop into a good player or it could be a bust. So, hearing different opinions on him is not surprising to me. He's smallish, like you said, in comparison to Conley. He's only about 5'8 or 5'9". The thing that I do like about him, he doesn't really let that size hamstring him at all. He's pretty feisty for the size, doesn't seem to give up much in physical matchups, but again, sometimes physics comes into play and he just can't do much there. Quite an intelligent player, which I think goes a long way to making up for some of those size deficiencies. In that case, I sort of compare him to maybe a guy like, say, Ray Whitney, who's managed to stick around the league for a long time as a smallish player by just playing really smart. If that's his high end, then I think the Canucks would be really happy. But there's also the chance that eventually that size kind of catches up to him too. So, I haven't seen him play in college and at the American League level. Certainly did very well at both those stops. Again, the 22 games is not quite a big enough sample size to say that he'll be able to translate the skill to the NHL level. But I certainly think he has a good chance as any, and really that's why he's at or near the top of the Canucks prospects list.
Kind of looking probably third ranked on the prospects list. Or maybe third ranked. It depends, obviously, who you speak to. But I believe I'm pronouncing his name right, Joseph Labatt.
That's correct. Yeah,
and Labatt. We talked about before. Schrader played in Minnesota. Well, Labatt's born in Minnesota, is now attending Wisconsin. Bigger guy too. Schrader's obviously a shorter player. Labatt's 6'4", looks like almost 200. Probably going to round into form over the next couple of years. What do you see for him in terms of? First off, I guess, what is his best asset, and how do you see him progressing over the next few years?
Also an interesting guy in that he went, right from Holy Angels High School right into college, kind of skipped the USHL step. He was, I think, a Waterloo draft pick, if I remember right, and sort of skipped that step, which is somewhat surprising, given that it sometimes takes defensemen a lot longer to mature. So going from Minnesota High School right to college is still a pretty big leap here. So, kind of a nice all-around defenseman with his size. He moves pretty well, puts up reasonable points in the WCHA. I think he's, most seasons been around about that 20-point mark. So, again, producing pretty well on a blue line that's typically fairly deep. Wisconsin's always kind of known for having, pretty skilled defensemen, one through six. So, that's pretty well that way. The only knock that I saw, and I saw him again fairly recently here, is that took four doesn't use the size as much as a guy would like. Again, the college game is not necessarily conducive to, really the rough and tumble style, but you would like to see him sort of assert himself physically a little bit more. Again, coming from Minnesota High School might not always be the sort of the go-to thing in a defenseman's mind to, to make the hit instead of going for the puck or something like that. But I think when he transitions to the next level, he'll really have to bring that size to bear a little bit. That said, I do like him as a player, especially everyone says you can't teach size like that. And again, he brings some other things to the game that are a little harder to teach, especially the position thing. You rarely see him cut out of position. Stays between the dots pretty long, keeps everybody to the outside. So, again, pretty nice player there, too, for the Canucks.
You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are in the midst of our segment called Prospect Pulse, where we evaluate the prospects of various NHL teams. We're talking about the Vancouver Canucks prospects tonight, and we're joined on the line by Kyle Kozier. He's the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey. Kyle, the the hockey program in Denmark isn't world-renowned, but it is improving, and in fact, they had a first-round draft pick in 2011. The Canucks drafted Nicholas Jensen, 29th overall in 2011. You know, he's been playing, he played a couple games in the AHL so far this year. He's been playing over in the Swedish Elite League. You know, what are the prospects like for this Nicholas Jensen, 6'3", he's a right winger?
Well, I tell you, it, again, you know, the word Danish power forward probably don't leap to mind when you think of, you know, kids playing in Europe, but he had a pretty strong season in the Swedish Elite League. Just came over to Chicago recently here, so he's only played the two games. But I would sort of suspect if he can show any kind of scoring touchdown in Chicago, you might see him up with Vancouver sooner rather than later. Of all the prospects they have, you know, and including Schrader, Jensen seems like the one that could kind of come in and fit in well with the Canucks. And they saw Cassian's early season success playing on that top line. So, you know, might not be quite as rough and tumble as Cassian, but again, does play that power forward style up and down the wing. Has good scoring touch, finishes checks, tough in the corner. So, again, that's a guy that, you know, I think would slot pretty nicely into the Canucks lineup.
KK, Brendan Gaunce was the Vancouver Canucks' most recent draft pick, 26th overall in the 2012 draft. What do you see as his ceiling, and how many years away is he from being a regular NHLer?
That's sort of an interesting question. Like, the big thing on Gaunce that sort of held him back in the draft and is holding him back right now somewhat is his skating. Now, he is continuing to work on that. If he can kind of get the skating to sort of the NHL level or a little above, and not that it's not NHL level now, but it's certainly lower end. You know, he would fit in probably with his two-way skills, would probably figure it to be a top six guy. You know, so a big centerman there. Really very, very responsible defensively, but also, you know, does well on the offensive side as well. So, again, if you can get that skating to where he can compete and cover himself in the defensive role at the NHL level, you know, the ceiling for him is quite high. You know, so doesn't hurt to have a top six guy. And even on the Canucks, which has a fairly deep roster, you know, that's a guy that can step in there if, again, if the skating improves and give him a few options for either signing or moving some guys out to free up some salary, too.
The catchy name of this segment would be Frankie Corrado.
That one.
What is, who is he? He's a I can give the quote a little bit of a background. Fifth-round pick for our listeners, fifth-round pick in the 2011 draft. He's a defenseman. What do we know about him, Kyle?
Again, you know, we just kind of finished talking about Gaunce skating, and that's really where Corrado shines. A very, very smooth skating defenseman. Just moved over to Kitchener here from Sudbury as part of a trade. Sort of often talked about as one of those guys that might be kind of a later round steal, and for the Canucks that's really important. You're having drafted and you know, later on for several years in a row now, given their regular season success, finding these guys in the mid to late rounds would be very important for them too. So again, two-way game, contributes offensively, but really just a fluid skater. So you know, when you already have that in your back pocket coming into the NHL level and learning some of the other aspects of playing defense there, you know, makes it a lot easier if you can get around like he does. And again, never hurt to have that name because it just, you know, comes to mind quick. And oftentimes little things like that help when you're trying to recall guys. So, again, certainly has an NHL upside that way too. So if he can, you know, round out the other facets of his game, probably needs some time in the AHL again. You know, it's always good to have the time to actually learn how to play defense at the professional level. But again, with the skating, it's certainly a lot of upside for Toronto.
Kyle Kosher, the Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey, we thank you as always for joining us on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. It's a weekly segment, so Kyle, we're thrilled to have you on.
Anytime, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks very much, Kyle. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL Midweek. We're done. Is the Harlem Shake over with?
Is this a Harlem Shake?
Yeah.
I'd heard it before.
You're not missing anything.
Why is this popular?
It's like a video where people dance around and look stupid. I'm not into it.
I asked Reem to play it just because I like it. And
this is big?
It was. I think it's sort of
it's
passe
big.
Now. It's like the... It had a good... New Jersey is now beating Philadelphia 4-1. It had about a good two-week run, and we're pretty... It's pretty much over with now.
Still going.
Yeah, maybe in your life is, but that's about it. Over-under ends the Wednesday evening show. It ends NHL midweek. Throughout his career with the Columbus Blue Jackets, Rangers forward Rick Nash scored 547 points in 674 games played for an average points per game of .812. So far this year, he has 23 points in 21 games, an average of 1.1 points per game. Over under Rick Nash finishing the season with a point per game average of 1.0.
Over. I think that his first time he's played with real fully skill, talented players. He's playing, as we mentioned and broke down in the first hour, he's playing on the power play. It may not exactly be the best fit of five guys as a unit, but there's still a heck of a lot of talent there. And Rick Nash, by all accounts, I've seen him play a few times, and you speak to people like Andrew Gross, we had on last week, says he's been great. I think he keeps up the point of game status.
I am going to agree on the first over-under with Richie over because of the fact that he's only starting to get going now. He struggled early on. The power play for the Rangers, I'm confident it will get better. And Nash is the type of guy that I think is only going to get better as he gets more comfortable in New York. So over.
Over under.
Rangers backup goaltender Martin Bergeron turns 36 years old this year. Thus far in his 14-year NHL career, he has 230 career wins. Martin Bergeron will finish his NHL career with over or under 250 NHL wins.
Ooh, well, I mean, you're looking at it, so you're saying 20 wins, right, Drew?
20 more wins. The guy turns 36 this offseason.
So if he plays 20 or 15 games a year, he'd have to win at least half of them for three seasons. But if there's an injury, I'm going to say over because of just the possibility of injury, although Lundqvist has been pretty reliable. Remember when Bergeron was a prospect way back? Was that the Rochester Americans?
Yeah, he went from Buffalo over to Philly.
He was great in the AHL, if I recall correctly.
He was.
He was an awesome prospect, and he just never turned out to be that successful starter that people thought.
But he's probably one of the best backup goaltenders in the league.
It's fine. There's a lot of 1A, 1Bs now, right? So it's harder to say that way. He's a traditional backup.
I'm going to say under because he doesn't play a lot under Lundqvist, and I'm not sure if they try to strengthen the position even as early as next year. So, and I don't know. I'm going to say under.
I'm not sure why. Remus,
do you keep track of this? Good.
Do you think they would strengthen the position to give Lundqvist a lesser workload? Because his numbers are pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, they also play that tight style that we were talking about in the first hour, but it might not be conducive to the team they have, but it is a tight style.
I think if you went up and down, the NHL, Bergeron isn't one of the top backup goaltenders. I think he's somewhere maybe in the middle of the pack, if not below the middle of the pack. So I'm just saying I think that it'll probably be under. You asked the question. You're getting the answer.
Thank you. In the three full seasons since the Rangers hired John Tortorella as head coach, the Rangers' penalty kill has succeeded an average of 84.7% of the time. This year, through 25 games, the Rangers have a penalty kill rate of 84.3%. At the end of the year, the Rangers will have a penalty kill rate of over or under 84.5%.
I'll say over because of the increasing health of their blue line. McDonough, Delzotto, Girardi. So I'm going to go over.
Yeah, tough one, Drew. I'm going to go under because Stahl, they say maybe 2 to 3 weeks, but he may not be. And the other guys may be coming back. But Delzotto's not exactly the best defensive player, and I do have some concerns about the rest of that depth. You know, guys like Steve Emminger, with all due respect, shouldn't be forced into roles, even Stu Bickle. I'm going to say under.
Last season, the Rangers averaged 2.71 goals per game, good for 11th in the NHL. Mm-hmm. So far this year, the Rangers have averaged 2.48 goals per game, 21st in the NHL. At the end of the year, the Rangers will have averaged over or under 2.6 goals per game.
2.6 and they're at 2.48. I'm going to say over. And this goes back to what we talked about in the first segment. They've got to open it up in New York. There's too many offensively talented players. And the guys like Chris Kreider and TJ Miller, I just think they're... JT Miller are going to step it up and increase. So and Gabrick and Nash, I still think, haven't even hit their peak this season. So I'm going to go over.
I'm going to go under because, again, you're looking at, what'd you say, they're at 2.43 right now, Drew?
2.48, I think.
2.48, and you said, what, 2.6?
Yeah.
Who can keep track of all these numbers, by the way? But then they have to keep a pace of, what, about 2.8 or so? I mean, that's do they have the skill level? Sure. Will Tortorella change his style of play mid-season? I mean, while I think it may very well be necessary, I don't think it's probable.
Last question, as he threw this one at me before. Right now, there are four Canadian teams in a playoff spot.
So I'm going to make the show plan late in show. I like it.
Over or under four Canadian teams making the playoffs? Currently, there's four in there. So over or under four Canadian teams making the playoffs?
Richie, I'll go first. If it was before the season, I would have said under. But now that we're midway through this wacky abbreviated 48-game season, I'm going to say, I actually think it's going to be four. So I'm going to say even. I think the only two teams that don't make the playoffs are the Flames and the Oilers.
That'd be five.
That would be five then, Azzy.
Oh, sorry.
Seven Canadian teams now.
Sorry.
So you're going to go over this?
I forgot that the Jets are the seven.
It's your own question.
I, by the way, do think the Jets at this point are going to make the playoffs. So
I'm done with you, Richard.
Five. Over.
You think it'd be five, Ezzy? Right now you have Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, and Vancouver.
Right. Yeah. So I think the Jets are going to be that fifth.
The Jets will be in there. You think Toronto and Ottawa will both make it? No. I think I think Vancouver and Montreal, I think, are shoo-ins at this point.
You're going three, I know it.
I'm going to go three, yeah. One of Ottawa, Toronto, Winnipeg will make it.
All righty.
Keep your eye on.
Keep your eye on. Something for our audience to keep their eye on until next Wednesday, Richard Pollock.
Drew's taken out of town. Only one more show, and we get to take over.
Oh, boy.
The Leafs defense, we spoke about it when we were talking about the Jake Gardner incident, quote-unquote. But in reality, they do have eight defensemen in Toronto, jokes aside. And they have, you look at their left side, and we talked about a Fraser, and we talked about, you know, they have Lyles, who doesn't dress, and they have Gardner in the minors. They have Gunnarsson. They have Phaneuf, and then you look at the right side, they have some depth there. They could use some size of forward with some skill, and I think they have some defensemen, and there is a defense need around the NHL, as there always is. I think there's going to be a matchup, and you wonder if they maybe make that move earlier rather than later because they've lost a couple in a row here now. You don't want to make the desperation move in April when there's 3 weeks left. You make it now, you provide yourself with more time, like in a regular season, a regular 82-game season when there's some time before the end, when the trade deadline is 2 months before the season's over, a month and a half.
Ezzy, what should people keep their eye on?
I'm going to say Riley Nash on the Carolina Hurricanes. KK would like this one, but the Oilers actually drafted him and traded him to Carolina for a second-round pick. And he had a couple goals last night, and he's the type of guy that has taken a little bit of time to develop, but I think he's a really good player. And I think he's a guy that maybe they didn't factor in this year. They thought maybe he'd have to spend a little more time in the AHL. But he's got some speed, and he's got a nice scoring touch. So I'm going to say Riley Nash on Carolina. And I should mention, we've done six of these now, and a few of them, if not three of the guys of the rookies I've said keep my eye on, have ended up in the AHL or in the press box, JT Miller and Jacob Josephson being two of them. So I'm not necessarily saying these guys are going to succeed, but I think that, you know, they're starting to succeed, and he's one of those guys.
I'll wrap up. Keep your eye on the Detroit Red Wings and the Calgary Flames will play against each other coming up in about an hour's time, give or take, on TSN. Keep an eye on the Detroit Red Wings power play on the road. Through 10 road games so far this year, they're 0-36 wow. on the road. You know, and I don't have to tell you who the Detroit Red Wings have up front. You know, you would figure that that's a power play that's usually in the top, you know, 10, top 15 of the NHL. Have not scored a power play goal yet on the road this year. Keep an eye on that as you watch the Flames-Red Wings game tonight on TSN. That's it for NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show for this Wednesday evening. A big thank you to our guests, Mike Greenlay, the Minnesota Wild color analyst, and PJ Stock from Hockey Night in Canada. Big thank you to Bernstein's Deli for being an official sponsor of NHL Midweek. You can follow us on Twitter at Legal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/LegalCurve. And our website is www.legalcurve.com. In case you missed any of this program, it will be available for download both on iTunes and on the tsn1290.ca website. Saturday afternoon, 12 noon here on TSN 1290, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We will preview the Jets-Leafs game that will take place that evening. For my colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Remus, who's on loan to us from the TSN 1290 Roundtable, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. We wish you good night and good luck.
You've been listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. Join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for your midweek NHL update. And join Drew Mindell, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg Saturdays for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN 1290.ca.